Good afternoon. We'll call the Senate Resources Committee meeting to order. Let the record reflect it is approximately 3:35 this Friday afternoon, February 10th. We do have a quorum. Present is co-chair Senator Wagner. We have also with us today Senator Stevens, Senator McGuire, Senator French, Senator Wilikowski, and myself, co-chair Senator Pascven. Today, the Senate Resources Committee will offer a brief introduction of Senate Bill 192, titled An Act Relating to the Oil and Gas Production Tax and Providing for an Effective Date. My staff, Mr. Jeff Stepp, will simply read the sponsor statement into the record so that the committee and the public understand the parameters of the legislation as introduced. As noted last week and earlier this week, Senate Bill 192 will initiate a discussion first and foremost about the progressive features of the ACES tax system. The bill sponsor and the oil industry itself have advanced the argument that the upside is taken away at high oil prices because of progressivity. We now have before us a vehicle in Senate Bill 192 for engaging in that discussion. And as I have said, Mr. Stepp will quickly explain the bill and then it will be set aside. The department has been not asked to comment on the bill today, as they will, of course, have the opportunity to do so in the very near future, and as well as members of this committee will have the opportunity to comment upon it and the industry and the public at large. The committee will get into the nuts and bolts of progressivity first thing next week during the Joint Finance and Resources Committee hearings on Monday and Tuesday, which will be at 9 a.m. and 1 p.m. on both of those days. During these joint hearings, consultant Pedro Van Meurs will present four sessions on the Arctic and Alaska oil economics. Also next week, Senate Resources Committee will receive more analysis and modeling from PFC Energy Consultants, who are out of Washington, D.C., and they will be presenting to this committee on Thursday and Friday next week. So following Mr. Stepp's brief introduction of Senate Bill 192, Commissioner Butcher, who we see him in the audience, and we welcome him today with the Deputy Commissioner and Chief Economist, we welcome then to the Senate Resources Committee. But Commissioner Butcher, with whatever your staff you would like to have come forward with you, they are presenting today a document titled Alaska's Production Tax, Defining the Problem. So first, Mr. Stepp, welcome. Present the bill, and then we will have the commissioner. And I would also like the record to reflect that Senator Giesel is in the crowd, and former Speaker of the House is with us today. Any other elected officials? Seeing none. As always, the committee welcomes any members of the public or certainly former elected officials, and we hope that the public is paying attention. So with that, Mr. Stepp.
Chairman, you don't want a motion on the bill to bring it before us?
Yes.
That's a move. Backslash M. Senate Bill number 192, backslash M.
Any objection to receiving that version? Seeing no objection, the bill is received and before the committee. Thank you very much, Mr. Co-Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Chairman Wagner, and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jeff Stepp. As mentioned, I am staff to Senator Joe Pascavan. By means of a little, just a real quick background before we get into the structure of the bill, the current production tax structure, known as ACES, requires companies to pay tax upon what is called a production tax value, generally only when they are making profits from oil and gas production in the state. In addition, tax credits are provided for capital expenditures, with higher credits available for certain oil and gas exploration investments. The progressive feature in ACES means that the state, as the resource owner and tax collector, receives more production tax revenue when oil prices are high relative to underlying costs. Similarly, it significantly lessens the state's share of revenue when per barrel margins decline due to low oil prices. It has been the persistently high price of crude since the passage of ACES, which creates the potential for, as we have often heard, the upside potential being taken away at very high oil prices. When the request for this legislation is before you, Senate Bill 192, was made, the directions to the bill drafter were simple. Please draft a new bill that allows for one continuous progressivity rate under ACEs. That is, change the two steps so that there is 1.4% rate above $30 PTV. That is, eliminate the 9250 arm and remove the statutory maximum tax rate of 75%. I'll explain that a little better, a little more clearly. Senate Bill 192 is analyzed by the Department of Revenue in the fiscal note, which is in your packet. In fact, it was described so well by DOR that their language was incorporated directly into the sponsor statement that is also before you. And I, quoting here from each, Senate Bill 192 makes a change to the progressive tax rate portion of the production tax at Alaska Statute 43.55.011G by removing the second trigger of the progressive tax rate calculation that lowers the progressive tax rate to 0.1% on production tax values of $92.50 or greater. The bill also removes the statutory maximum tax rate of 75% under the production tax statutes. The bill retains the initial trigger of $30 in production tax value, at which point the progressive tax rate is calculated as 0.4% per dollar increase in production tax value. I hope that's clear to the committee and the public. We'll explain it more as the bill progresses through the committee. Given the Department of Revenue's fall 2011 oil price, production, and lease expenditure forecast through what's referenced in the fiscal notes FY 2017 in the analysis, but I believe if you look at the front of fiscal note, it should say FY 18. The tax rate changes from the bill are not projected to have a direct revenue impact. The fall 2011 forecast through the time period covered by the fiscal note ranges from $106 per barrel to close to $110 per barrel for ANS crude oil. Combined with anticipated production levels and lease expenditure projections, DOR's forecast does not anticipate production tax values meeting or exceeding $92.50 of PTV per barrel. Therefore, based on DOR's most recent forecast, the progressivity rate changes in SB 192 will not impact revenue expectations. If oil prices were to increase, or if production were to increase with no corresponding increase in lease expenditures, and again, I'm still quoting pretty much from the fiscal note, production tax rates and therefore revenue could be increased from this bill. With current production levels and current transport costs and lease expenditure levels, much of North Slope crude oil would be subject to a production tax increase under SB 192 at $120 to $130 per barrel and above. Without a maximum production tax rate, as is advanced currently in this bill, tax rates could continue to escalate until they exceed 100%. Marginal government take exceeds 100% at approximately $140 per barrel when holding all other assumptions constant. This means that at $140 per barrel, the government would take more than 100% of every dollar that the oil price increases. And that's the end of the fiscal note, Mr. Chairman. In conclusion, while some have assumed that this legislation would result in a tax increase on the industry, DOR's fiscal note seems to assert, to repeat, quote, based on our most recent forecast, progressivity rate changes in this bill will not impact revenue expectations, unquote. The fiscal note is quite clear on the front page that through FY18, SB 192 would not increase the amount of revenue paid by the industry or collected by the state one single penny. In the final paragraph of the fiscal note analysis, scenarios are presented in which progressivity rates may become a burden. However, it's important to note that this scenario is not part of DOR's projections. The risk to the industry then appears to be low. Still, that risk will be addressed by this committee in the forthcoming discussion about Senate Bill 192. The bill has an effective date of January 1st, 2013. That summarizes my introduction. I'm happy to take a crack at any questions.
Any questions? Seeing none, thank you. With that, we would welcome the commissioner, Commissioner Butcher. and Deputy Commissioner Tangeman, welcome. And you would like to come forward, whoever is from the department, you would.
Would you like to come forward? I think that's it.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Brian Butcher, Commissioner for the Department of Revenue. With me is the Deputy Commissioner for the Tax Division, Bruce Tangeman, and then we have a host of folks that I won't go through their names. It's the usual cast of characters that can give us some details, if need be, beyond maybe what Mr. Tangeman and I can provide. We've been asked to kind of lay out what we see as the problem, and we're very appreciative of the opportunity. Facts to begin the conversation, and these are things that I'll just touch on briefly because I'm sure the committee's aware of all of these. Oil, we've seen oil prices begin to climb to all-time highs starting in the mid-2000s, and they've been the highest sustained period of high oil prices in history that we've seen. We also seen the throughput through the Trans-Alaska Pipeline System continue its steady decline. We've also seen other oil-producing regions enjoy production and employment booms. The reasons for this are fairly obvious. With higher-priced oil, there are extra work, extra developments that have become economic that wouldn't have been economic at $20 a barrel oil or $30 a barrel oil, or a lot of what we've seen up until fairly recently, as well as technological improvements that are always going on. And we've also seen the competition is high. There are many areas to invest around the world, and we're obviously one of them. Touching on the resource issue, because there have been folks that have wondered, are we running out? According to the State Department of Natural Resources, as well as the United States Geological Survey or Service, it's not a resource issue. We're still a very resource-rich state. There's cumulative production from the North Slope through 2010 has been over 16 billion barrels. It's estimated that there are 40 billion barrels of conventional oil still up on the North Slope. Gas, there's estimated to be between 200 and 300 trillion cubic feet of conventional natural gas. There's also tens of billions of barrels of heavy and viscous oil, as well as large shale plays and shale oil, as well as gas plays. These, the heavy and shale oil, although we know they exist, are more speculative, and there are real questions on when they'll be economic and what will be needed to make them economic. And so those are things that DNR and DOR are currently working on, but are far less kind of proven as the light oil that we have traditionally developed on the North Slope.
If I could interject, Commissioner, just the record should we reflect that we've been joined by Senator Stedman. He's been here for a while, but I did not indicate that on the record, so welcome, Senator Stedman. And then also we've been joined by Senator Thomas, is in the audience, and we do welcome Senator Thomas as well. So,
thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you.
In fact, according to the federal government, Alaska's North Slope is not even considered a mature basin, with over 70% of state land up there being minimally explored. Other important points to consider is that as a state, we're in a position that we've never been in before. For most of the last three decades, we have been sitting on the largest untapped oil reservoir when it was first started producing in North America, Prudhoe Bay and Kuparuk. Light oil, very easy once production started to continue to produce. As the production began, very high pressure field, over 90% of what was being produced was oil, mixed in with some water and gas. That has now completely flip-flopped in terms of what's coming out of those fields. We're now seeing over 90% of what comes up being natural gas and water, with less than 10% being oil. So still plenty of oil to be produced up there, but not nearly as easy and not nearly as inexpensive as it was when Prudhoe Bay first started producing. taking a look at the PPT ACES debate, we talked a little bit about this when we were in front of the committee last week. We have, fortunately, a lot more information looking back on operating expenses, capital expenses, than we did when those debates were taking place. And hopefully the added information can play a valuable role as we go forward in shining new light on the issue that we may not have had as much of during those 2006-2007 debates. What do we see as we look in a big picture? As we looked around, and I'm sure most of you, in fact, I know most of your, all of your offices have received a copy of Alaska's oil and gas fiscal regime that we put together, and it's also on the Department of Revenue's website for any members of the public that would like to take a look at it. We tried to bring together a comparison to the best we could of oil-producing regions to take a look at what's happened there and try to make as close to an apples-to-apples comparison of fiscal regimes as we possibly could, although when you do read through the book, you see that it is not an easy task to compile the information or to make a comparison with all of the variations between taxes, different types of taxes, royalties, tax credits. Numerous things have to be weighed to try to look at it as a big picture. The one thing we do know is that Alaska continues to decline. Unfortunately, more years than not at a higher percentage than the department has forecasted. This is a slide of the largest oil-producing jurisdictions in North America. And you can see the dotted green line is the price, which you can see bounced around between $10 and $30 or so through the 70s, 80s, and 90s, and then really began to spike up in 2004, 2005, peaking in 2008, and then having a precipitous drop and then building back up again. The bottom red line is North Dakota, which had been fairly constant and has begun to increase. The reason that's there is this is a state that's looking at passing us in production what they thought was 18 months from now, but the last conversation I had with the Revenue Commissioner, they think that they'll be passing us inside of 12 months. Then you can also see Alberta, which bounced around with periodic increases and decreases over the decades, but the production curve has moved upward at a higher angle since about that 2005 when more became economic than had been previously. And what I find most interesting about this slide is the blue line, which is Alaska, and the yellow line, which is Texas. Texas has been producing oil about 80 years longer than the state of Alaska has. You can see the decline that we caught up and evened out with just about the late 80s, early 90s, when we peaked at a little over 2 million barrels a day production. And then for a couple of decades, the Texas decline curve and the Alaska decline curve are almost identical. And then at the point, as we get into the 2000s, that you see the spike up in prices, you see the Texas decline curve begin to flatten out and begin to creep upward. You see the Alaska decline curve to continue on the same angle that Texas had been until that period of time. So that, for one, is a state that was dealing with the same decline curve we were. They've been producing much longer than we have and have figured out a way to turn that around.
Senator French has a question. Commissioner.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Commissioner, last time we were together, we asked about the new production in Texas, about whether it was conventional or the new shale oil. You opined that it was conventional. I think we sent, I know I sent you a email asking for some sort of source documents on that. Have you been able to get any of those together for us?
Through the chair, Senator French, I apologize if it's been a few days late. I think we were getting it to your office today. I can certainly pass a chart over to you that I know is part of the response. And just to point out for the committee, it shows the Eagle Ford Shale is where almost all of the oil shale in Texas has been coming from. And up until 2009, it had been anywhere from 787 barrels a year to 308,000 barrels a year. In 2010, which is the the last year we had information for with Texas, it got up to 4.3 million barrels for the entire year. January through November of 2011, which isn't on our chart, it jumped up to 21.8 million barrels. And so it might have been close to 24, 25 million barrels for 2011. That's expected to go much higher in 2012, possibly as high as 300,000 barrels a day extra. So when we talk to the Texas Railroad Commission, which is the equivalent to the AOGCC in Texas, and inquired if the flattening out and the begin curve up had to do with shale oil, his explanation, the executive director's explanation, was absolutely not. This was all conventional oil that became more economic at high oil prices that flattened it out and crept it up. And he said, watch 2011, 2012, and 2013. And you're really going to see that move up. And that is going to be primarily because of oil, shale oil.
Senator Wilkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One of the things we heard from a recent testifier was that Texas has a reserves tax on the oil that's in the ground, and that when the price of oil becomes very high, then the oil companies want to get the oil out of the ground as quickly as possible so they don't have to pay a reserves tax. And I'm wondering if you've looked into that, if you know what the percentage is, if you think that had any impact on what is happening in Texas.
Through the chair, Senator Wilkowski, we didn't, that I can remember, get into any details about the reserves tax. In fact, it didn't even come up.
Through the chair, Senator Wilkowski, that will be part of our comparisons to other oil-producing areas, though. And again, that's a tax that we don't have that other regions do, so that helps muddy the water a little bit in the apples-to-apples comparison, but that is considered in our comparisons. And for the record, I'm Bruce Tangeman, Deputy Commissioner for Department of Revenue.
But we'll get back to you with details on that.
Thanks.
Senator Stedman has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think when we take a look at, for instance, if we're going to look at Texas and Alaska, or we can look at North Dakota and Alaska or Alberta, whatever, but I guess the conversation point is Texas. Do they have similar barriers to entry that we do? Are they like landlocked with ice, or do they have a pipeline, one avenue to get out? Do they have basically one subsurface owner? So everything else basically is equal except for our tax structure, or is this a more complex question than that?
Through the chair, Senator Stedman, no question this is a more complex situation than just pointing at one thing, taxes. I mean, obviously, labor is easier to get. You're dealing mostly with private land in Texas, so you're not dealing with a lot of the extra permitting you are here. So there's definite benefits that they have in Texas. What they don't have in Texas, with the exception of the new shale play, is the size of the reservoirs that we do. And so it's kind of a double-edged sword a little bit, where that's just one more barrier we have to deal with in Alaska that they don't, which is it costs a lot more money to do business up on the North Slope in Alaska than it does in Texas or Alberta or North Dakota, for that matter. And that's something that has to factor into the equation when a company, as an example, looks at where they're going to do business. Because you're right, it's not even there. There are many more difficulties up here than down there.
Thank you.
Please continue.
Slide 6 is one of the pieces of information that Commissioner Butcher mentioned a few slides back on that relates to the position we're in now that we as a state and you as decision makers were not in during the PPT and ACES debates. We can now look back at the effects of the net tax on our state. And granted, this is a short time frame because we went from gross to net, you know, during that FY07 time period. But I think it's important there's been a lot of rhetoric on what has happened under ACES and jobs are up and capital spending's up. Well, we're now in a position to look back and really look at what's actually happened. And that's why you'll notice there's two boxes on this slide. I wanted to point out where ACES took effect. It was the ACES debate took place in November of 2007, about halfway through fiscal year 08 on this chart. As far as the capital planning by the private sector, they would have probably already had their calendar year 2008 capital plans in place. So the next box, I think, is important to point out that the ACE's impact on capital decisions by the private sector probably would have fallen somewhere in this time frame. Again, this is a fiscal year. They make their decisions on a calendar year basis.
You know, what I'm trying to do in understanding this, you know, and I'm looking at the revenue sources book, fall 11, at page 31, and for FY 11, FY 12, and FY 13, they show capital expenditures, the CapEx, and it starts out in FY 11 at $2.3 billion, FY 12, $2.7 billion, and then FY 13, $3.0 billion. So it seems to be contrary. In other words, it's a progressing CapEx expenditure.
Chairman Passman, you're correct. The numbers in the revenue sources book are a forecast. What we're looking at on slide six are actual numbers. And in a couple more slides, we'll do a comparison of what the forecast has been compared to what actual expenditures have been. I think we'll see, similar to the production curve, where the department has historically been overly optimistic on the oil production curve, we're also starting to see that on the capital expenditure curve. And granted, we've been forecasting oil production for decades. This is a new element. So while we do show increasing trends in capital spend, between 10 and 11 it's down, and then the next slide we'll talk about 12 a little bit. So while we're seeing a dip now, we're forecasting hopefully a turnaround, but time will tell.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Stittman.
Yeah, I'd like to just follow up on that same type of conversation, because when I, you know, just drew those FY 12 and FY 13 numbers, the blue line would have went all the way up to where Southeast Alaska is on the chart. You can barely see it up there, but it's nice to see that we're included in the state. And the operating expenditures ended up at $2.3 billion in FY 13, which is substantially below about where the blue line stops right now, but it'd be clear over on the chart. I think what would be helpful, if we had the actuals and we had the projections out, because clearly we have 12 and 13 in the resources book, but my understanding is you've also got data showing years beyond 13 that have been submitted by the industry for whatever it's worth and future expenditures. And then on the same chart, if we could, we could go back and actually track the actuals versus the expectations, because I notice on your next chart down, it's monthly data versus annual data, and it's hard to calculate it and drop it on the chart, because I think this is a representation that is not expected in the FY 13 budget. We're expecting capital expenditures of $3 billion and preparing the state to pay credits on $3 billion, 56 million in capital expenditures, and we're expecting the budget to have an impact with credit calls and facilitate that. So we want to make sure that we're synced up here.
Through the chair, Senator Stedman, you're correct. And I would like to point to FY 12 in the revenue sources book. While we're showing $2.7 billion when we were putting this together, if we jump to slide 7 real quick, and we'll come back to slide 6, but the bottom left-hand corner shows capital spending, FY 11 year-to-date, FY 12 year-to-date. We're 13% below what we were at tracking for actual expenditures last year. Mm-hmm. So clearly, to get to that 2.7 that's in our forecast, and we will be redoing a spring forecast, we're missing it severely right now. And again, this is a you know, we've only been under this net tax for 4 or 5 years now, so it's obviously a learning curve. But that's one example where we're missing pretty severely right now that we will be going back and addressing.
And if I could, Mr. Chairman, if I could just add to that this monthly is more of a snapshot of where we are for the benefit of the committee. It's not something that we're showing and saying we need to make a change based on this slide, because this could completely turn around. We could end up higher by the end of the fiscal year. We just don't know. But the snapshot, after finishing lower than we thought last year, is halfway through this year, we're also looking lower. So it's more insight than it is definitive information.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Stedman just, and Senator French. And
just a brief follow-up. So can we, Mr. Chairman, then have the graph restated with the additional data that's included in the source book along with the projections that the, I think you guys have 4 years out or some number ahead of us that aren't in the source book, revenue source book, and then some analysis done on expectations versus reality the last few years, because there's a huge difference in the numbers.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, Senator Stedman, we'd be happy to do that. We can put that all on one chart.
Senator French.
Thank you. The point's been made, but I went ahead and before I came down, I did the same thing that Senator Stedman did, which was to take a look at actually what's going to happen according to what's in the revenue source book. And my understanding is the revenue source book numbers come from industry. It's not as if you're just simply dreaming these ideas up. You go out and say, what are you going to spend next year? And you put together your estimates. So it looks like we're going to get back to a healthy capital spend. It could be wrong. Something could change. But, you know, we're projecting pretty good rise in capital with a decrease in operating.
Through the chair, Senator French, that could very well happen, and I hope for the benefit of the state of Alaska it does happen. The point we were trying to make was that we receive most of our production forecasting from operators as well. I mean, we deal with DNR and AOGCC, but we also get, and it tends to be overly optimistic because you've got companies looking ahead in the future to production and to spend levels that aren't decided by their boards of directors yet, and we've noticed historically that the information that we bring in tends to be on the optimistic side for the production forecast. We're seeing potentially the same kind of thing when they're trying to project what their spending is going to be, that it would be more likely to fall on the optimistic side because these are operators working at a particular place that are looking forward to what's going on and don't have a direct role in the decision making of the company on a corporate level.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Just an additional request. I'd be interested in seeing this data go back to 2000 if possible. And do you know, do you have any idea what the expenditures were, CapEx, from, say, 2000 to 2005 or 2006?
Through the chair, Senator Wilikowski, going back into the gross tax days is we did not receive the same information we're receiving now. So I do not believe we'll see what we can produce, but we're certainly not receiving the same information that's feeding these numbers here.
Right. And thank you, Mr. Chair. I've seen older charts that have capital expenditures. They've been provided by you, in fact. My recollection is they showed a drop of about 40% or so in capital expenditures at a time when we were hitting all-time record highs under the old tax system. So I think that'd be important for us to see, so we can see the whole spectrum. But one other question I have was just on how the forecasts are made. What kind of information do you require the oil companies to provide you? Do you require them to tell you which fields they're planning on producing, how much in each particular field, and is there a penalty for not giving you accurate information in the forecasts?
Through the chair, Senator Wilikowski, we work with every company that's producing, every operator, not just on a well-to-well level, but also on a field-wide level, to gather as much information as we can. We also work with DNR and AOGCC to make sure that the information we're getting, such as, say, a company that expects to be starting production in 2012 or 2013, is actually going through the permitting necessary to get to that point, so they're not being overly optimistic, because those are things that we can check out. As far as if there's a penalty if they're not forthcoming with us, not that I'm aware of. We could ask Sherry Nienhuis on the phone, but I'd be surprised, seeing as it's such a speculative issue, that it would be extremely difficult to try to determine if they were doing that, and I see that. I don't know why there would be any reason for them to do that either. But,
and through the chair, Senator Wilikowski, I think as soon as you would attach a penalty, you'd see very, very low capital estimates, because they would want to come in over consistently. So our goal is to try and get the most accurate information as possible, and that's through a give-and-take process with our partners. I think if we start trying to incorporate penalties, it's going to change the dynamic on their goal of presenting information to the state.
Right. And thank you. Yeah, and I don't know if it's a good idea to do it or not. I was just questioning whether or not that was the fact. And I think it's important. I think you would agree, by the same token, it's important for us in managing the resource that we have accurate information.
Absolutely.
But the other question I had was, I think it would be helpful for us to try to determine what the cause, if there was a decrease in CapEx or OpEx spending, if it was because of a delayed permit. I think that would be very helpful for us to know. If a company said, hey, we're not spending because on this particular field because it's no longer profitable under ACES, that'd be very helpful for us to know. I know I've asked information for some time about which fields are not being developed or which projects are not being going forward because of the oil tax structure versus other, whether it's structural impediments or permitting impediments or what. So I think it would be helpful for me at least to try to bear down and figure out where the pinch point is and why aren't we getting the capital expenditures that we aren't. And if it's because of the tax structure and we can show what the net present values are and the IRRs, that I think that'd be very helpful.
Through the chair, Senator Wilikowski, I think a lot of that, I've heard some of the DNR presentations and some of the processes they're going through and changing how they handle permitting and some of their lease changes. So I think that would probably be a presentation in and of itself. I don't know if you've seen anything, but it seems like they're going through a lot of changes to try and streamline. And I know the Commissioner Sullivan has been putting in a lot of time and effort during the interim out promoting our state. So we can't speak to that specifically, but I think they're trying to move in that direction. And I just one quick follow-up on the that Senator Stedman mentioned when you mentioned FY 12 and 13 and the capital spend going up. A new part of the capital spend projections that is new to the state are the explorers. And these are folks that do not have a tax liability. They're not producing yet, but we've all heard the enthusiasm, which is great, that they are here, they're exploring, and they're taking advantage of the incredibly generous suite of tax credits we have on the books. So while the Great Bears and the Repsols are here in the exploratory mode, and we're not forecasting production from those speculative plays yet, we're hoping down the line, but we're not in a position to forecast the production side, we are taking into account the capital spend side and the forecasts that they're presenting there. So again, we're 4 or 5 years into the capital history spend of the bigger producers and the folks that have been here. These new companies that are coming in, we're learning with them just like they're learning about our state. For instance, the Great Bear, one of the first Great Bear presentations, you know, last year at this time was very optimistic about 200 wells and hundreds of thousands of barrels flowing within the next couple of years, I think. Well, I think as they learned how the state works, how the process works, that the shale play is brand new up there. I believe in House Resources during an interim subcommittee hearing, you know, they came back with a revised plan and they were looking at 6 wells, I think, to kick off this winter. So those are some of the things that we as the state, the Department of Revenue, we sit down with these folks, we hear their enthusiasm, we listen to their capital spend plans, but then we have to take a step back and say, okay, what's realistic? We have to look at what's optimistic and what's realistic, and I think that's a good example of, you know, if we were to run with the first presentation, our capital spend forecast would have been another $1 billion on top of this. So it's important to take those things into account, to temper some of that.
Would you agree that you know, capital expenditures by a company aren't necessarily influenced by tax policy? They may be influenced by the national economy, the international economy. For example, you know, what happened several years ago where the entire world's economic system nearly collapsed. Corporate philosophy may affect capital expenditures. You know, those types of things are main drivers, wouldn't you agree, of capital expenditure determination?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, it's a number of things. And every company has different dynamics that they're working with. I mean, you need only look at the three major producers on the North Slope and see what each of them
has dealt with over the last year or two to see that they all have different perspectives on the same area of the state. So you are correct that it is a complicated issue.
But I would also add that I've heard that some folks believe put very little into the tax regime as far as one of the knobs that goes into decision making. Personally, I think it's a large knob for the decision makers when they're deciding where to spend their capital. So it's one of many variables, and I guess you could put little weight on it, or you could put a lot of weight on it. I'm leaning towards it's on the upper end, I believe, as a decision making tool.
Sure.
Senator Oldacre.
Thank you. My understanding is Prudhoe Bay is somewhat unique in that we have the Prudhoe Bay Operating Unit Agreement, which can you just talk about that for a minute and how investment decisions are made as far as Prudhoe Bay and whether or not there are similar type of agreements for Kuparuk or any other of the larger fields?
Through the chair, Senator Wilikowski, that would be a more appropriate conversation for DNR, I believe. We haven't spent a tremendous amount of time digging into the on the revenue side, digging into the operating agreements that I'm aware of.
Just a quick follow-up. Is it, and the real basic, my basic understanding is the agreement at Prudhoe Bay says you have to have agreement by all three producers, BP, Conoco, Exxon. So if one of those producers says we don't want to produce, we don't want to explore, we don't want to do infill drilling, that they essentially have veto power over the other two. Is that your understanding as well?
Through the chair, Senator Wilikowski, again, I would repeat what the commissioner said. Hopefully during public testimony we can have those folks giving you the exact way it operates from their mouths.
Please continue.
Slide 8 is a slide that does show the forecast versus actuals. There is one mistake. You either need to move the fiscal years to the right or all the colored lines to the left. They're off by 1 year. So if you notice, the black line is the actual capital expenditures. The dotted line is the forecast. The first colored line is the maroon line, and that line should be shifted 1 year back, which would show fiscal year 10 at $3 billion. And again, this is, I'd like to emphasize again that this is a new process for the state in general because we've only been under the NET system for 5 years or so. But this is a very similar look to what we've seen doing the same type of analysis on the production forecast side, where you show the 10-year production forecast layer over layer over layer, year by year, and then you lay in the actual production forecast and the actual production, which has been consistently under that. So again, this is a similar slide that will continue to grow and will continue to add years onto it. But I think it's important to show we do show the increase in our forecast, the dotted line.
Well, again, getting back to the FY12. Do you believe it is a material mistake in the revenue source book to forecast for FY13, the $3.0 billion capital expenditures?
Through the chair, or Senator Pasquin, I would point back to slide 7. And again, we're showing that we're 13% under FY11 through the first 6 months of 12. There's 6 months more to go. If it rebounds and it flips and we're back to 13% or more above, then we're going to be back on track. I think based on the best available information that we have, and again, we're taking into account people that have been companies that have been here for 30 or 40 years who have a lot better history of their capital spend plans and how the environment affects their production and the capital needed. We're also dealing with these new explorers and new companies that have come to the state in the last couple of years because of the generous tax credit. So there's going to be a steep learning curve. Kind of weeding through the discussions about their optimism of what they see versus what will be the actual capital spend from them down the line.
Senator Stedman has a question.
Mr. Chairman, I think maybe one of the things we should consider asking the department is to break out Prudhoe Park and Alpine, the legacy fields, in their capital expenditure data they're going to bring forward. And clearly, there's a different spend pattern there that we're concerned with versus the other fields, and it might help us a little bit as we, you know, go down the line. Also, if I could ask Mr. Chairman to have them explain a little bit to the public this when and the timing of how they integrate with the industry and come up with the forecast for capital expenditures and how many years out that the companies file with them as far as their targeted years of capital expenditures, and then how many times a year that's updated and when it's updated.
Through the Chair, Senator Stedman, part of our Monday presentation will be just that. We've gone through a five-year look back to see what the capital, basically we take these numbers right here and we break them down into five categories looking backwards, and we'll go through that process, but we do break it down to get a better handle. Going forward, we're going to break those five categories even further so there's an expectation of what we're looking for in the forecast also for the capital spend. So we'll get into more detail on Friday or on Monday.
Just so we don't lose the first request, the breakout of Prudhoe, Caparic, and Alpine.
And I was going to mention that also. We're looking at different ways that we can show that graphically on Monday as to the explorers versus the producers, you know, that type of breakout. So hopefully we'll have something like that ready to go on Monday.
As we get back into trying to analyze ACEs, in a simplistic fashion, it breaks down into two pieces, the tax credits and the progressivity of the production tax. It appears as if our tax credits have been very popular. They appear to be going up on a yearly basis. The enthusiasm of explorers, wildcatters, some of the smaller companies coming in, seeing the tax credits as an opportunity to get in and pick up some leases has been very positive. And that's why when the governor, you know, has began to discuss a change to taxes, he wasn't talking about getting rid of everything. He was focusing very specifically, most specifically on the other side of it, which is the progressivity side of it, which we're hearing from companies that have had difficulty finding larger companies that do most of the operations to produce, as well as larger companies that would look at doing a lot of it. You also have companies, larger companies coming in saying they like the looks of the tax credits, but at the point in which they make decisions based on production, they believe something has to change. I know that when Mr. Tangeman mentioned earlier, Commissioner Sullivan has done a very good job of going around talking to every possible oil company he could to try to drum up support for the lease sale that we had in December. That was a very successful lease sale, and I think he did a very good job of getting the word out that Alaska, what we have up here and what the value is, but more than anything else, he heard, and these were from companies that did business here and don't anymore, companies that have never done business here, your taxes are too high. We have no high end. And he'd come back and say to me, hey, when are you going to do something about that? You know, like DOR is hurting DNR's ability to bring more companies into the oil patch. And so there really is not just, we believe, a problem with the high oil price progressivity of our taxes, but there really seems to be a kind of a corporate-wide industry feeling about it, and I think as companies give public testimony, you're going to hear a lot more detail than I can give, but it's something that not just we have heard, but Commissioner Sullivan have heard over and over.
Senator Stedman has a question.
On that, you know, I'm a little bit puzzled, and I've heard that those comments, well, they've been made to me directly by some of the companies, where an explorer might come in, absorb the 30% or 40% credit, do some work, and then want to flip their business, sell their business to a existing producer. So why wouldn't the producer in a free market just pay the fella less because he absorbed all the upfront capital costs or capital credits, leaving the purchaser with the higher tax bite, which is certainly known and they're able to calculate it, why wouldn't he just pay him less for his asset?
Through the chair, Senator Stedman, that company has to determine that even paying less for the leases still has better value for that company than what they could do with their capital in another state or another country. And I think that's where the breakdown is. And I think you'll hear those stories because they're stories we've heard.
And just to expand on that a little bit, they might be able to realize a short-term 50 cents on the dollar purchase, but then their cash flow model would show production for the next 10, 20, 30 years. So while it might be a quick, they might get a deal on the front end, they're going to have to deal with this high production tax for the next 30 years. Oops, sorry. So that's also part of their decision making.
Senator French has a question, then Senator Wilkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. One of the things I really thirsted for in this sort of look at how we promote more investment are some examples, some sort of real examples, because, I have listened to the same arguments you've listened to, that, if you lower your taxes, you'll get more investment. And that's been a steady drumbeat across the state for a couple of years now. And I accept that they're, that the industry people who are saying that believe that and would work to make it so. But I guess I just feel like I need a little more concrete details before we move tax policy and engender or endanger, education spending, transportation spending, spending on all the other things we have to do. And so one of the things I've asked for is, give me an example of a project that's on hold because of ACES. Tell me how much it would cost, how much oil it would make. And that way I can see what the barrier is. I can see it in real dollars. I can see, you're only going to make 10% on this, and you can make 20% in Australia. I understand that now. And I haven't been able to get a concrete example. I don't know whether you've been given those examples or whether you've asked for them or whether you have the same sort of thirst for an exact sort of numbers-driven set of scenarios so that we can get a better feel for what we're doing.
Yeah, through the chair, Senator French, absolutely we do. And we have had those conversations with companies. I mean, we understand that it's not going to be a quid pro quo, tit for tat. But they do need to come up in front of the legislature and be as specific as they can about what a material change in taxes is going to do. We've had those conversations with everybody we've had an opportunity to have. The companies have not had an opportunity in this committee to testify publicly. I assume they're going to, and at that point, they will have the opportunity to give you the kind of detail hopefully you're looking for, because we agree with you that there is a responsibility on the level of the companies to give us some information on what a material change means.
Follow up with Senator French.
Follow up, and I know we're getting a little short on time. I don't want to keep you from your presentation, but you haven't received those numbers, and just to, so everyone knows, I specifically asked for the information, and frankly, the industry doesn't have to wait until they're here in front of us and in the stand. They have avenues of communication open to them: a letter, an advertising campaign, a brochure. I just hope they're not waiting to be sort of formally asked in front of a committee to say, look, here's how you can make us more competitive and provoke more investment. So thank you.
Yeah, just following up on that, you've proposed the bill. You've had this bill's been proposed for over a year now, and you've passed this out of the House. And are you saying that in the year that you've promoting this bill, you don't have a single example of a project that's been delayed or put off because of the tax structure?
Through the chair, Senator Wilkowski, that's not what I'm saying. I said from the very beginning that we, as the state, will lay out what we believe is the problem and what we believe the solution is. The companies have to come forward and explain what the material difference is for it, and they've had over a year that they've been waiting to do that and haven't had the opportunity either. So we feel like it's responsibility on one side of us to do that. We don't really need to speak for them when they're available to speak for themselves.
And just one more quick point. I believe they have been on record over the interim about some very hefty investment potential of $5 billion for Conoco, $5 billion for BP, I believe. And they did list some projects that would be economic with a reduction in the high production tax. So they put some of those. I agree with Senator French. We've heard a little bit of detail. They've whetted our appetite a little bit, but it would be good to see some details on, have them expand on some of those projects that they've mentioned in the papers and that type of thing.
And I would just,
Senator Witkowski, follow up.
Thank you. Yeah, and I would just reiterate, I want to see the projects. I want to see which projects have been delayed, how many barrels of oil they'll produce, what their net present value is, what their internal rate of return is. I want to see the numbers, because I personally have a hard time giving billions of dollars in tax breaks without having the data. But I just want to get back to one thing which you talked about, which was, and I've heard this over and over again, that you keep hearing from other companies that our fiscal terms are discouraging investment. And I pulled up a document that you relied on. It was the 2010 Fraser Institute report, and it asked 645 oil company executives, are Alaska's fiscal terms, do they encourage investment, discourage investment? And 74% of the respondents said it either Alaska's fiscal terms either encouraged investment or were not a deterrent to investment. 17% said was a mild deterrent, and 6% said it was a strong deterrent, and 3% said would not invest due to this criterion. So 74% of oil company executives are saying Alaska's fiscal terms are either encourage investment or are not a deterrent, according to the study you relied on.
Through the chair, Senator Wilkowski, and I think it's difficult to break that down unless you have the details on who's looking at tax credits and who's looking at progressivity.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Stedman.
I'm looking at some different numbers, but if I heard the commissioner right, so we shouldn't really take any validity in that. Was almost a beauty pageant type survey, and I forgot the name of the outfit that cranks it out every year now. Oh, slipped my mind off the thing. So we shouldn't, Fraser, right? So we shouldn't spend a lot of time dealing with that issue. Is that what I'm hearing?
Through the chair, Senator Stedman, it was a snapshot of the perception. And in fact, I think if you look at the 2011 Fraser, you're going to see Alaska looking worse than they looked in 2010. It's a snapshot that we used early on, and as we dug into it a little bit, as we've been in our jobs longer than 2 weeks, we realized that, like you say, having a beauty slide that gives a sense of what folks see as Alaska, it does not have as much value as digging into some of the details.
I would agree with that. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Commissioner, is going back to the Fraser report a year ago, if I recall correctly, that is the study that defined fiscal regime. Is that correct? And that definition of fiscal regime excluded production taxes, correct?
Yes, if I remember correctly.
So if one looks to the Fraser study for an analysis of fiscal regime, it has to be with the express understanding it is not assessing the issue that we are addressing here, which is production tax.
Well, that is correct. We were giving it as a what the views of Alaska from companies were, more than a specific. I mean, it's not a report that digs into the specifics with any kind of clarity, but it does give you a general sense of how companies view Alaska.
And just to expand a little bit, if it's not including the production tax and the result says that it's, whatever the report says, obviously the production tax is the biggest tax involved. So if that's not being included in the survey, then that's definitely going to skew the numbers. And I think one important point that the survey would need to delve into to be Alaska specific would be, do you like the tax credits? What is your view of the tax credits? So if you have a company who's not producing, is an explorer, who has no intention of ever producing, they're going to find something and they're going to flip it. Alaska is a great place to invest. Absolutely, with the generous tax credit systems we have. So I think that's one step deeper into who are these folks and what sort of business are they in.
Senator Stedman has a question.
Just a brief comment, and it's probably going to be a little longer in this process than all of us would like, but as I recall, the Fraser's study or report used, it was kind of like to bonk the legislator over the head last year, not so much from you guys, but just generally. I remember the slide being in several presentations around the state. So it's refreshing to see that after you two folks have been seasoned a little bit in your job, that you're recognizing that some of the data and presentations used around the state are less than useful in trying to fix this problem.
Absolutely, and through the chair, Senator Stedman, I think that figuring out the split, you know, the production tax credits and then the production tax itself is a huge discussion, and that doesn't always get fleshed out in these surveys that are a little more general. So it was important to make that distinction.
Is another way to say that is that if you only focus on one component of the load on industry, you can very much deceive the listener as far as its rating or assessment with other jurisdictions?
Mr. Chairman, I would agree with that. And that's what makes the issue as complicated as it is. I mean, if we could bring one slide out and point to it and say, well, here you go, time to make a change, that would all be great, but that's not realistic. There are far too many levers to weigh to determine all of it, and that's why we've been here as long as we have and will continue to be.
Thank you. Please continue.
Okay, slide 10 just kind of emphasizes a few of the changes that have happened as a result of ACES. As we're all aware, the ACES tax tripled what the ELF tax was a couple of years earlier, a substantial change. We're also very aware that tax credits by year have also gone up quite a bit.
If I could, in other words, the $29, and we've had conversations about this in my office, and, you know, the $100, are you intending that to be the ANS crude price and the application of progressivity upon that?
Yes. We're just taking $100 as an example. It could have been 117 like it is today. It could have been 90.
So, and just to expand on that a little bit for clarification, basically if you lay these two scenarios out in the income statement format where you start with the price of oil and you back out transportation costs, and under the ACES you would also back out OPEX, CAPEX, et cetera, and you run down that calculation, you'd get the $29. Whereas if you go under the ELF system, it's a lot easier, and the tax was also a lot lower.
I believe that if you start with an ANS crude price at $100, subtract royalty and subtract your $27, $10 each OPEX and CAPEX, and $7 downstream transportation, you get, and after the, it's $20, not $29. So I think we should. In other words, I think the $29 is off.
Mr. Chairman, this is a taxable barrel we're looking at, not royalties not mixed in on this. This is looking at it taxable after royalty.
So to explain a little further, you were there with the $100 minus the $7 for transportation costs, minus 10 for OPEX, minus 10 for CAPEX, would get you to the PTB of $73. So that's 100 minus 27 gets you 73, and then you start your tax calculation. And no, that's where you do the base rate.
I've done it both ways, and I think if you start out at 115 ANS price, subtract your royalty, subtract your 2750, that you're still significantly less than 29. So in other words, when we talked about this in the office, I have trouble with this $29, because whether you calculate it as a $100 ANS price and subtract everything from there, including royalty, or you add the royalty on top, you start out at approximately 115 ANS price, neither analysis gets you to $29.
Senator Passman, it's you're backing out those numbers to get to 73, which the tax is then calculated on, and that tax is $29. So you get to $73 PTV, you calculate the base tax rate is 25%, you calculate
which is 18.4% of 73, correct? So the base rate is 25% of 73.6 is 18.4.
The total tax rate on a $73 PTV is 42.2%. That 42.2% of $73 is $30.81.
Well, anyways, Senator Wagner.
Well, one thing I would like to see, if you could bring it back to us, had nothing to do with what the current discussion is, I'd like to see you put a third bar in here on PPT and where we're at with PPT. Because you've jumped all the way from ELF up into what we currently have in the system. You've left out what's in the middle. And that's not a very good visual to me. So I'd really like to see where we're at with PPT.
Through the chair, Senator Wagner, we have a slide coming up that gives a bar chart, not broken down per barrel, and we will do that. But it does show you ELF, PPT, ACES is introduced, and then ACES is passed.
I understand. I've seen that, but okay. I want the bar chart.
Here. Okay. Right. Absolutely. Yeah.
Senator Stedman.
I'd like to go back to what the chairman was talking about. I've got a similar issue. I think what we need to do, and this is the beginning of these hearings, but we need to agree on the format so we all understand what's on the table to discuss. Otherwise, we're going to be going in circles. And dealing with the calculation as you walk down through the tax, where you start out with your gross value, taking out your royalties, and walk on down. It, to me, is a lot cleaner way, I'll give it here in a minute. The black-haired guy from Gaffney Klein,
Rich Ruggiero.
Ruggiero's analysis, walking through on the marginal and effective costs, goes through that top down. But then in some of your guys' calculation, you start out with ANS, take out transportation cost, and then take out royalties. And what we're doing is coming up with different numbers, and that's why Senator Pascavan has a different number than you do. I've got the same issue here with the printouts. Done two different ways, and we operate basically the top-down approach, and I think that's how the taxes are calculated. So what we're trying to watch is net cash flow. So it might sound a little nitpicky to the audience, but it swings the numbers substantially, and we have to agree on the format. So maybe we can work that out, so we don't have that. And then I've got some questions on the slide, but I'd like to hear from the commissioner on that subject.
Sure. Through the chair, Senator Stedman, it's important to look at these two different ways. It's important that for the state of Alaska to look at it from the point of view of the state and what the state take is, but I think that when you're looking at increasing the investment climate for a company to do business in Alaska, you have to look at it from the point of view of the company as well. So I agree with you, we need to agree on where we are, but we also, I believe, have to agree that it needs to be looked at more than one way.
Follow up.
All right. I don't disagree that it's good to always try to put yourself in the other fellow's shoes and try to figure out what his issue is and where he can come to a solution at. I don't disagree with that. But I think it is very confusing to the legislators, and even more confusing to being complete mumbo jumbo to the audience trying to follow the numbers that aren't as familiar with this complicated tax as we are. And it is complicated, so we need to clarify that process. And I would encourage the chairman that we do a format of top down, just like the tax is calculated, and we concentrate on net cash flow. And that's the basic game at the table, so we can agree on the numbers. But with that being said, Mr. Chairman, my question on the chart, two things: the chart on the left with the credits, and I've talked with the department about that. We have the credits But then we also have the immediate write-off of capital expenditures and the value of that. I think we need to have some discussion on that and the magnitude of that, because it's hundreds of millions, if not over a billion, per year. And then also, as Senator Wagner referenced, kind of a reworking of that other chart, and I am a little bit concerned that we don't suffer from a benchmark error, that ELF, the ELF system, was so far out of line on a worldwide perspective, it virtually, to me, is worthless. It's just the wrong benchmark. So it's nice to put it on there, I guess, for entertainment, but I see no real validity to it. And then especially when we compare it to the column next to it, when we can't even agree on what that number should be.
And then ultimately my question, whether the $29 is accurate or not, or we're using a different benchmark, if the analysis is $29 for the state of Alaska and $71 for industry, do you consider that fair?
Through the chair, Senator Passman, that's not what this slide is showing. We'll get you the spreadsheet that walks you exactly penny for penny to get you those numbers, and I think once we sit down and walk through the spreadsheet, it'll be more clear.
Thank you. I think the committee does look forward to that.
Slide 11 takes a look at how other states rank Alaska. We watched the presentation by Dr. Gerking last week when he was discussing that making an effective tax comparison would be an enlightening exercise. And so we went and looked to see what we could find throughout other oil-producing jurisdictions, and this is what we were able to find. And so the state of Montana has put out a comparison between them and a half dozen or so oil-producing jurisdictions. And as you can see, we're strikingly high in our effective tax rate compared to any other state on this chart. And that's just, like I said, after Dr. Gerking was mentioning that there would be some, this would give us some insight, this is what we were able to find. We also had...
I believe that that is not what Dr. Gerking said, but, you know, isn't this exactly what we discussed just a few minutes ago, that if you take one component, the production tax, you can very much skew or mislead the listener? And so here we have, for example, it indicates that California has a 0% load. That's not accurate, correct? I mean, that's just not true.
Right.
So, I mean, again, I'm trying to make sure that the listening audience understands that this is looking at a very, very narrow window as compared to the broad analysis of the tax or load on an industry.
That is correct. And as I was about to say, this gives you a snapshot of how another state looks at it. We also have had quite a few discussions with Alberta over the last 6 or 9 months, and they do something very similar to this, where they compare about 10 jurisdictions, including Alaska, that they feel are their competitors. And it is their desire, it's their goal to be in the upper quartile in terms of investment climate of the other oil-producing jurisdictions. In fact, they'd like to be number one, which was Saskatchewan in their list. But that's something that we looked at and was something that we could appreciate, because we're also in a situation where we're competing for capital dollars. And so this is just a snapshot of many snapshots that emphasizes the complexities of comparison, but also points out that, much like Alberta, we paled in comparison to most of the other jurisdictions.
And just as a quick follow-up, I think what Dr. Gerking, the way I heard it was, he was looking for let's have an easy, effective tax rate to calculate. Let's look at this in a very easy way. Let's take the revenue collected, let's divide it by the value of the product, and there's your effective take. And I think that's what this strives to do. Now, granted, it's not an easy process to do. It's not an apples to apples like that. But that's what Dr. Gerking was trying to get to.
We'll get to Senator Wilikowski in a minute. But, you know, you are focusing here on Montana. And you look to a Montana slide. But even in your own oil and gas tax regime publication of January of 2012, I don't see them as what you even consider a peer jurisdiction that you would compare us to. So again, I'm somewhat concerned that you are focusing on a jurisdiction that your analysis that was released within the last week or so doesn't even include as a peer to us.
Mr. Chairman, the point we're trying to make with this slide is that when somebody comes forward and says we need a very easy slide that compares effective across jurisdictions, that it's not that simple. And we're not, we would have led with this slide if we thought it was a reason why we should say, oh my gosh, look at this. We're way higher than anybody else. We need to do something. It is more complicated than that, and that's the point we're trying to make. The fact that we're many times higher than all the rest of them, it's something we would have expected, is not the point we're trying to make.
And it's not specifically we want to compare to Montana and look at their taxes compared to our taxes. There are several jurisdictions on there that are in our document. So we're using something that's produced and online by Montana, and that was, you know, was something we found in the first 10 minutes. And it's certainly an example. It does include other jurisdictions that we do compare to.
Thank you. Yeah, and I would agree with the comments made. This does nothing but confuse things. You look at North Dakota, and you've got a 6% tax, and we know that they've got, for sophisticated landowners, a much higher royalty, a royalty that can be twice the size of Alaskan royalty. They've got a sales tax, whereas we don't in Alaska. So it's just hard to really gain anything. I think this adds to the confusion. But one question I had on Dr. Gerking's testimony, he testified he looked at jurisdictions all over the United States, North America, and he was unable to find correlation between tax increases and production rates. And I'm wondering, and he studied that over 50 years, and I'm wondering if you disagree with his testimony and if you have any research to rebut what he said.
I didn't watch word for word everything he said, so I'm not going to get into a he said issue there. I did sit through the Wood McKenzie two-day seminar that the legislature had, and they said that tax rate reductions resulted in more investment over all scenarios, and which makes sense, but you know, it's the first time I'd had an expert actually say that. And
Just not trying to put words in Senator Wilikowski's mouth, but the question was not investment. The question was production.
If I could respond, sir, I watched most of the presentation. I was in the audience, and he seemed to put very little weight on the price of oil, which I found kind of interesting. I put a lot of weight on the price of oil, especially when we're trying to compare, you know, what happened under ELF and, you know, why decline continued under ELF. Well, it's because the price of oil was between $9 and $20 that whole time. And that's not a very attractive time to be investing anywhere, let alone here.
What's the source of your information that you're relying upon price as the elastic point that would drive the issue?
That's my personal opinion. I believe common sense would lead you to believe that high prices would drive investment. So it's, you know, that's my own personal opinion.
Mr. Chairman, this gets me fired up. Prudhoe Bay is declining because it's an aging field. It's a normal decay curve in an elephant field. This is nothing abnormal around the planet. They thought the field had been drained 10 years ago. So, to reference that, you know, the price was down, that's why we had decline in volume, I just don't agree with it. for the last 20 years, the volume's been declining, and we're trying to stop the decline of this elephant field and preferably increment it up a little bit. But I don't think, well, I would challenge the department to bring forth information that would show us that we've had declining production in Prudhoe Bay and Kuparuk because the price was down, and it wasn't a natural evolution and decay of the field. And also, to produce an analytical model that would show that a field like either Prudhoe or Kuparuk, when you opened it up, would stay at then its potentially its peak production, flat. I've never seen any models, oil basins look like that. They all have a big rapid rise, and then humped over, and then a long tail coming out, and that's what they use in laying out their cash flow for the discounted cash flow model for the decisions. So that statement goes completely contrary to about everything that we've seen here since I've been sitting here. I don't believe you.
Mr.
Chairman. No disrespect.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Stedman, I think in every conversation I've had with a company, the price of oil and the amount of money they can make off of oil has a large component on whether or not they're going to go forward with the development or not. And as we mentioned a little bit earlier, what's going on the North Slope with a depleting field, no question, it's much more expensive to produce a barrel of oil than it used to be. And there are certain kinds of oil that would be produced at $100 that wouldn't be produced at $30 or would be produced at $200 that wouldn't be produced today. I mean, I think you're going to discover that when you talk to the companies about it. I'm not saying that it would flatten it out because it wouldn't flatten it out. There is a natural decline, but there are things that can be done if it's economic, that wouldn't be done if it wasn't economic. A lot of the infill drilling and a lot of the things that have gone on and will continue to go on.
I agree with what you just said, which is totally different than the previous comments about why Prudhoe Bay or the referencing the production curve of Prudhoe Bay. There's no question that there's potentially incremental oil that we can pick up. And there's hurdle rates that the industry says that can't be met, and we're going to work on that over the next couple months. So I don't disagree with what you said, but I just disagree with the characterization of the long 20-year decline in Prudhoe was directly a price-sensitive issue. What drove that decline was the natural decay of the field itself. And we'll go forward and over the next couple of decades and always try to slow that down and change that direction, but inevitably, every barrel we pump out, there's one less barrel to come up. You can't get away from it.
Just to clarify, to get on the record, I agree with that if we're looking at Prudhoe Bay, it's a basin that's going to have a decline. That's why looking at Texas is so important to me, because they were producing for 80 years longer, and probably not from a Prudhoe-sized field, but when oil prices rocketed, they flattened out. And when we bring Alaska into that discussion, nobody debates that it's a tremendous resource up there still. It's probably a different resource than Prudhoe. But if you look at some of the research that's been done by EIA, et cetera, they don't believe that we've been explored hardly to any great depth. They might be a little optimistic, but I'm, you know, Prudhoe, yes.
Right.
But I'm saying at high oil prices, there's a lot of resources up there to exploit. And other pools up there would help flatten the curve. So,
Senator McGuire had a question, and
she's
waiting patiently.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. I'd invite the department. This seems like a good time to bring this up. I've wanted to ask this for a while. We talk about other states and other places, and I want to talk about Cook Inlet for just a second and gas. And I'd like to ask the department, when you have an opportunity, to run a few models for us just with respect to Cook Inlet and what we've done there with Senate Bill 309. It strikes me that there are similarities. You've got an aging field, roughly 50 years old. Many people believed that all of the easy gas was taken out, if you will. Nothing left to incentivize, and that the price itself would govern any kind of investment in the future. You had very high prices at one point at the Henry Hub, $11.47, ranging back down to $1.47, a combination of different credits thrown at it and reductions in rates. All those kinds of scenarios have played out right here in Alaska in Cook Inlet. My understanding from everyone I've talked to is that after the largest Cook Inlet lease sale in state history, and now the second jackup rig coming in, we're experiencing somewhat of a South Dakota boom in Nikiskie. You have car dealerships that have business up by 40%. You have housing rates going back up again. And so rather than even, in addition, I guess, to considering South Dakota and other places, look no further than right here in our state, what this committee has done with tax incentives and lowering tax rates right here in our state. I'd like the department to come back to this committee with some examples of what Senate Bill 309 has done to incentivize gas development here in our state.
Senator Wagner, then yeah. Senator Stedman.
Yeah, and we didn't get into a lot of detail on why Texas's production levels kicked up. The detail I would like to see if we're going to use those comparisons is how many wells were brought back online that were not producing and brought yes. back online because of the price of oil. Because I happen to know, I've hunted East Texas, and I know what happens, and I know how those wells work, and they're all producing again now, and they're producing very little oil each, but it doesn't take too many thousand oil wells to be producing to produce a half a barrel to 3 barrels a day to add up at this price, and that's what's happened to a lot of Texas. So, Eagleford's one thing, but we just don't have the number of wells they got there. And if you talk to somebody outside, they'll tell you the average well produces U.S. wide 3 to 5 barrels a day. That's it.
Stripper wells.
Yeah. What do you got most of out
there? Senator Stedman had a question.
Yeah, I think Senator Wagner's right from our meetings that we travel to on that issue. Now, looking at that chart, Alaska being on top of it, I must be reading it wrong because it's 26.8 and statutory tax 25, so our progressivity rates only cost 1.8%. So how come we're complaining? I don't know how to interpret it.
Through the chair, Senator Stedman, this is something that was published. Obviously, there's a lot of backup to it that we'll get for you to show what went into it, but the important takeaway is not just to look at our number, and I think that's what we need to add to this discussion going forward, is we need to look at those other dozen numbers and how we stack up. And it is critical to look at the state take and how we'll be the revenue impact for us going forward, but we need to compare to these other regions.
I was just trying to poke a little fun at the issue at the end of the day, because we all know it's not 1.8.
And through the chair, and you noticed I did not try to respond, Senator Stedman.
Well, we are going to be picking up Commissioner Monday morning, and so I think we've kind of come to the end of the day. I know a lot of people. Anyway, to make it short, Commissioner, Deputy Commissioner, to your entire Department of Revenue staff, we thank you for the work that you've put in preparing the presentation for us and providing the information that you have. As we know from the start, there's work to be done, and if we can start using more common numbers, I think we can reach better conclusions sooner than later. So I think that's what our goal hopefully will be. But with that, Senate resources for Friday, February 10th is adjourned.